So, hi. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
In the back, I'll try to project.
Good.
Yeah. Hi, Laurel. let's see. Today, listening to Norman's talk about the end of Sesshin, I started thinking about all of the times that I've come to Loon Lake and done Sesshin here. And the first one was, I think it was 13 years ago, and it was my first ever Sesshin. And my dad had recently died, and my mom had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and I was a mess. I was heartbroken, and I remember I sat at the back of the Zendo, you know, utterly confused by all of these forms and chants and all of that. I sat at the back of the Zendo and wept throughout the entire Sesshin, and I wept quite audibly. And the entire time I kept waiting for somebody to come and ask me to leave, and that never happened. That was, you know, 7 days, I think, at that point of Sesshin, and I was just allowed to sit in my corner and weep. And I think there probably is still somewhere at Loon Lake a little patch of wet rug somewhere that contains my tears from that Sesshin, that first Sesshin. And then after that, I took care of my mom, and I kept coming back to Sesshin because it helped, you know. And then a couple of years later, and this was exactly 10 years ago now, 10 years ago this November, in 2004, my mom died, and I couldn't come to Sesshin that year. And I think I did we have email back then? I can't remember. I emailed or phoned or something, because I had to cancel at the last minute. And I asked Kate and Michael to include her name in the memorial. And they did. And that helped too, just knowing, even though I wasn't here myself, knowing that you know, that her name was being chanted in this space was really helpful to me. And so then year by year, you know, Sesshin comes and it goes. And when it's over, every year it feels like a dream. And when it's happening, it feels like the most real thing in the world. So it's kind of funny that way. And here we are. Here we are again. Amazing. I've been wondering about this moment for a long time, wondering what it will feel like to sit here in this deep silence of this ritual space and open my mouth and hear words emerge. What should I say? I'm writing these words on my computer, sitting at the dining room table in my friend Linda's apartment near Canby and Broadway. The apartment's on the 15th floor, and I'm looking north at a panoramic view of the Vancouver skyline and the mountains beyond. Although, in fact, I can't actually see the mountains, but I know they're out there somewhere, hidden behind the clouds. And it's raining, of course. Raindrops run down the plate glass, and I'm wondering what I should say in 2 weeks from now to you, who at this moment exist only in my mind, behind the clouds. Update. I'm writing these words in a small study under the eaves in a wooden house on an island in Desolation Sound. There's a storm brewing and it's raining, of course. Outside, in the forest, the heavy cedar boughs are being tossed by the wind, and I'm wondering what I should say next week to you who at this moment exist only in my update. At this moment should now read at that moment, a moment which is no longer and exists only in my mind and yours. You, on the other hand, are no longer imaginary. You are real. or at least as real as I am, and we're sitting together here and now in the deep silence of this ritual space. What should I say? A Dharma talk is a ritual, but all language is kind of a ritual when you think about it. It's a system of symbols and symbolic behaviors based on arbitrary rules, which we perform collectively in order to mean something. These utterances or marks on the page have been handed down to us through time from our distant ancestors. Most of the time, we perform language unconsciously, so we don't notice its ritualistic nature. But not here. Sesshin is a ritual space. Everything we do here, sitting, standing, walking, eating, speaking, and lying down, is part of that ritual. Ritual scares me because I associate it with performance, and performance scares me. I struggle with performance anxiety. Performance happens in the moment, and maybe I don't trust the moment. Maybe I don't trust the right words to emerge in the moment. Maybe this is why I write. I'll come back to this later. But ritual, particularly religious ritual, scares me for another reason too. My father was an anthropologist, and my mother was a linguist. And I come from a tribe of agnostics and empiricists and scientific rationalists. Ritual, like superstition or magical thinking, is something we find interesting. We study it, but we don't believe in it, never mind perform it. To cross that line has always seemed like a taboo. But here I am, a priest and a writer, trying to perform this ancient ritual of a Dharma talk in Sesshin and feeling quite confounded. What should I say? Maybe I could use a different metaphor, something more modern. For example, I've often thought that technology is what we scientific rationalists invent in order to defeat time and space. And if this is true, then perhaps language is a technology enabling us to time travel, allowing me, for example, to cast my thoughts into the future and speak to you from my past, which has now become our present. And now that we're all here together, these words, these little packets of information expressed as sound, travel through space, from my mind to my mouth, to your ear, to your mind, defeating the distance between us, the separation between you and me, self and other. Are these thoughts, once spoken, even mine anymore? Were they ever? Where do my thoughts end and yours begin? Which synapse signals the transition from one mind to another? Technology or ritual? Same or different? Does it matter? This is a kind of magical thinking I love. The ancient Greeks believed that the dead come back to life through language. When you recite the words of a dead poet, it's actually the poet borrowing your tongue in order to speak and to live again. So, here's Dogen.
Butsudo wo narau to wa jiko wo narau nari.
To study the Buddha way is to study the self.
Jiko wo narau to wa jiko wo wasururu nari.
To study the self is to forget the self.
自己 を忘れるというは満法に生せられるなり。
To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things of the world.
満法に生せられるというは自己の信心および他己の信心をして脱落せしむるなり。
When actualized by the myriad things, the body and mind of self and the body and mind of others drop away.
Goseki no kyū katsu naru ari, kyū katsu naru goseki wo chōchō shutsu naru shimu.
A traceless trace of realization remains, and we express this ungraspable trace endlessly. I think I've been watching too many samurai movies. I wanted to speak the words in Japanese because I thought Dogen might feel more comfortable borrowing a tongue that spoke his native language. Although, now that I think about it, maybe I'm underestimating him. Maybe in the last 761 years, he's picked up a little bit of English. And actually, I'm sure he has, and not just English either. You know, by now, he's borrowed so many tongues, he's probably fluent in many languages. So really, reading his words in Japanese wasn't completely necessary. It was more just politeness, you know, to make him feel welcome. But I also think that the Japanese words, they sound beautiful. And there's a meaning in sounds that's different from the meaning in words, and something that's more like music than thought. So I keep circling back to these words by Dogen about the self, because they describe my experience both as a Zen student as well as a student of writing and literature. The self is a starting point for both. Who am I? What is this? Why do I suffer? These are the kinds of questions that keep bringing me back both to the cushion and to the page. And during our practice period, the class that I've been teaching has been the title, I think maybe we finally got it, Practice Realization Expression, Dogen's Path of Creative Enlightenment. And we've been studying in this class the teachings of, in Japanese, Shusho Itto, which means practice realization or practice enlightenment. And it's a simple idea, but it's difficult to fully realize. The idea is simply that practice and enlightenment are equal. They're one and the same. And so practice is what we're doing here at Sesshin, the practice of Zazen, or Shikantaza, just sitting. And why do we do it? Why do we sit here, immobile, hour after hour, in silence, often in pain, enduring these aching backs and knees and broken hearts? Why do we do this? What do we hope to gain? Well, according to Dogen, nothing. We hope to gain nothing. And this is really a shocking proposition, especially nowadays, because everything that we do now, including friendship, is quantified and evaluated in terms of payoffs, yields, benefits, number of hits, number of likes. If we take Dogen at his word, and if we really think we're not going to get anything at all from this, then why are we here? Why do we stick around? Why don't we all just get up and leave? And there's a kind of cognitive dissonance that arises here because this teaching of practice enlightenment is at odds with the way that we experience the self and also the way we create the self through story. And Norman and Michael have both talked about this, but you know, starting with the Buddha, most of us are drawn to this practice because we're looking for some sort of relief or liberation from the narrow confines of the self that cause our dissatisfaction and unhappiness. And this is the basic story. And there's many variations, of course. Maybe we're actively suffering. Maybe we've developed addictions or habits that we feel trapped by. Maybe we just want to be a little bit better or a little bit happier, a little less stressed. So we follow the Buddha's plot line and seek liberation from the self through meditation. Underlying our stories, and underlying all stories, is a plot, a causal relationship. We suffer, so we seek liberation. We strive in order to achieve our goal. So there's this relationship, cause and effect, means and end, practice and outcome. If this, then that. And this causal relationship is what story is. But Dogen changes the story, and he takes away the plot line. Meditation, or Zazen, is not a path to personal enlightenment, but rather a direct expression of the enlightened being that you already are. So when you sit down on your cushion, you position your body in the posture of the Buddha, and you are the Buddha. You're expressing your faith in your own Buddha nature, and embodying not only your enlightenment, but the enlightenment of all beings in the entire world. At the moment of practice, you and the entire world are enlightened, even if it doesn't feel exactly like that when you're sitting on your cushion waiting for the Tenken to ring the bell. So this sounds like really great news if you buy it. And I think the problem is that most of us can't buy it. Our stories run counter to it. We can't buy it or believe it because we really, honestly don't feel like enlightened beings. And even if we did feel like enlightened beings, and even if it were possible to have just a moment of feeling like an enlightened being, we know for sure that others aren't. But that's okay, says Dogen. Don't worry. Just sit. Just do it anyway. Sounds like a Nike ad. Just sit. And so we do. We sit here in silence, in pain, knowing we're supposed to be practicing goallessly without a gaining mind and manifesting our Buddha nature on every breath. But somewhere in the back of our minds, we're like, yeah, sure, Dogen, whatever, and secretly nurturing our hopes for some little bit of breakthrough, some little tiny bit of improvement. Or we sit here listening to all of this talk about pain and suffering, thinking, wow, my experience of Zazen isn't like that at all. Mine's actually quite pleasant, kind of a little bit blissful even. So this must be practice enlightenment. I must be doing it right. We're so hopeful and so hard on ourselves. We're so convinced we're doing it wrong and everyone else is doing it right, or that we're doing it right and everyone else is doing it wrong. And either way, we're pretty sure that at least some of us are not Buddhas. But I think the problem here is a failure of the imagination. We're just not being creative enough. So let's just imagine for a moment that Dogen is right. What if we are all Buddhas, every single one of us, enlightened beings, perfect, just as we are, sitting here in this ritual space, expressing the Dharma together? What if, by sitting on our cushions hour after hour, studying the self, we really are forgetting the self and are being actualized by the myriad things of the world, right here and right now? What if our body-mind and the body-mind of others is dropping away and there really is no separation between us? What would that look like? What would that feel like? Maybe it would feel just like this. This question, what if, is the gateway to the imagination and also to ritual. What if opens up infinite and endless possibility, taking us beyond the limitation of our small, cramped, quantifiable selves. When we practice Dogen Zazen, we enter his what if, this generous, joyous, compassionate field of liberation where we sit, eat, walk, sleep together as if we are all Buddhas. And this magical question or proposition, what if, is something that ritual shares with the arts, particularly with fiction and theater. In order for a play or a novel to be successful, we must willingly suspend our disbelief and respond to what if as if the proposition were real. What if requires that we surrender to the moment in order to unlock the transformative power of the imagination. And I think this is true for ritual as well, but there's a difference. When the play is over and the house lights go up and everyone leaves the theater and returns to the real world, when the reader finishes the last page, she closes the novel and goes back to doing her bookkeeping or answering her email. In other words, a duality exists between the real world and the imaginary world of the stage or the page. But in our Zen practice, there is no duality. There's no separation. All the world really is a stage, and all the men and women and all the myriad things, the mountains and rivers and grasses and pebbles and roof tiles, are all players in a vast and incomprehensible performance, which is both beginningless and endless, which we call reality. In the rituals of reality, in the rituals of the Dharma world, what if requires us to surrender to the activity of the moment. And I think this is what Dogen is encouraging us to do when he talks about wholehearted practice and exhorts us to concentrate our efforts single-mindedly. And he exhorts us, too, to practice zazen as if saving our heads from fire. He's trying to encourage us to surrender completely, 100%, to the activity of the moment, to suchness, to this reality, to just this. And then in this way, engaging in every activity wholeheartedly, zazen, kinhin, eating, walking, sweeping, chopping vegetables, cleaning the washrooms, as if we're Buddha, we express our practice realization, which is our true nature. So Taiyan Dan Leighton, a Buddhist practitioner and scholar, has written about Soto Zen ritual and ritual activity as a performative expression of reality. He calls it an enactment ritual. He even proposes that we look at Dogen Zazen as a performance art in which its upright posture and every gesture expresses one's enlightenment practice. And I love this as an idea, but I wonder, can it be true? I know that my practice of zazen inspires my writing, and when I sit down to write, I bring my zazen mind to my artistic practice. It grounds me and enables me to tune in to the more subtle movements of my mind and body. But Taigen's comment makes me wonder, what can my artistic practice teach me about zazen? What if I think of zazen as an art and apply what I know from writing to my practice of meditation? Can creative practice bring new energy to sitting practice? In the Zen arts, tea ceremony or archery or flower arrangement or calligraphy or no theater, the artists treat their tools as if they were ritual objects. The Ikebana artist selects just the right vase to work with the flowers, which he's chosen to harmonize with the seasons. The calligrapher slowly grinds his ink to exactly the right consistency and then collects his mind before carefully dipping the brush. In the ritual practice of zazen, or shikantaza, our tool is our body-mind. So what if we handled ourselves with the same kind of careful attention? What if we were to hold our bodies gently and firmly with the same care and love that a tea master would show for a precious tea bowl? What if we were to sit upright on the cushion and align our spine with the precision of an archer stringing an arrow? What if we were to concentrate our minds on each breath with the same immediacy and imminence and intimacy as the calligrapher in the moment before her brush makes contact with the paper? And what if we sat seshin like this, as if it were an art form we were creating together, in which each one of us has an equal role and a part to play, and not only equal, but utterly essential, as if the creative expression of the enlightenment of this Sangha body relied on each one of us to be alert, awake, and present? What if we were to support each other like this, enacting our love and gratitude with every breath and every bow? As Michael said so beautifully the other day, we don't come to Sesshin, we are Sesshin, all of us together. Where do I end? Where do we begin? The separation between actor and audience falls away. The body-mind of self and the body-mind of others drops away. No one is acting. No one is watching. When we feel our mind wander, we come back to our body. When we get a little sleepy, we sit a little straighter. Each person's zazen is exactly right and exactly what's needed to express our collective practice realization right now. Each one of us is perfect in our imperfection. It's hard enough to practice like this in Sesshin, never mind in life after Sesshin. And I think maybe the problem is that our imaginations are hobbled by who we think we are and what we think we are. We can't see beyond the paradigms, empirical, rationalist, materialist, capitalist, or whatever, and we're limited and blinded by them. And I think I'm going to stop there. I'll just add this, that I'd really like to think of the imagination, think that the imagination is the mind's eye that can see the little tiny Buddha on the little jeweled throne at the tip of every blade of grass. And I'd like to think that this is the eye of practice that Dogen talks about. And so I'll end there for now. But we have a tradition here at Mountain Rain, and that is that the Shuso sings a lullaby. And I'm not much of a singer, and I don't know many songs. So I'm going to ask you to help me. Let's sing together, okay? So please just join in. This is a song that everyone knows. And it's a song, I think, that Dogen, in particular, would like. And maybe he wrote it, for all I know. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. Row, row, row your boat. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. I've been wanting to do that for 13 years now. Thank you.